from the University of Oxford with us today. He will be talking about exponential error suppression for near-term quantum devices. He is currently a Glassstone Research Fellow at the University of Oxford. He did his PhD from the Technical University of Munich, working on phase-based representation of quantum systems. And then he joined Professor Simon Benjamin's group in the University of Oxford, where he has been working on the quantum theory of near-term quantum computers, including variational quantum algorithms and error mitigation protocols. So thank you very much, Balint, for joining us.
For the very comprehensive introduction. Thanks very much. And also thanks for the organization. And yesterday, I'd like to talk about this particular kind of error mitigation scheme, which is in some sense different than all the rest of the error mitigation schemes, because here we have kind of a parametric family. We introduce redundancy into our system, just like in case of error correction. And with this, we can improve the performance of the error mitigation technique. But let's just start from the beginning. I'm sure you already know that many companies are involved in building larger and more mature quantum computers, including Google and IBM and so on. And in some sense, we have already entered the supremacy regime, so that we have large and mature enough quantum computers that we can't even simulate with classical computers. And I'm sure you are also aware of Google's demonstration of supremacy. And so I'm bringing this up not because of supremacy, but because of two points. First of all, it was just a demonstration. It's not in any way a useful algorithm. It's more like a benchmarking task. So we cannot use it to solve real-world problems. And so it might be still years or decades away that we can use quantum computers to solve real-world problems. And the reason for that is actually also very nicely illustrated in this paper. It's because of exactly this plot. So here they increase the numbers of qubits up to 50 plus, and they plot the fidelity on a logarithmic scale. And so as you can see, this fidelity goes down in a straight line in the logarithmic plot. So it means we have an exponential decay in the fidelity if we increase the scale of the computation. And unfortunately, this is the daunting prospect in case of noisy quantum computing, that if we add more and more gates to our quantum algorithm, let it be because we want to estimate ground states more precisely, or because we want to apply our algorithm to larger problems. But if we increase the numbers of gates, we have an exponential decay in the fidelity. And we can't really do anything about it unless correcting the errors. And this is why people already in the early ages have come up with error correcting codes. And I'm now just collecting here the most important properties of quantum error correction. I'm sure some of you are already familiar with this, but I'm just then restating this. So in case of error correcting codes, we need to introduce some redundancy into our system, meaning that we now have a separation between physical qubits, the ones that we fabricate onto a chip, and logical qubits, which ultimately emerge from these physical qubits by encoding physical qubits into some error correcting codes. And in this case, if we are above some threshold, and if we just add a little bit more physical qubits to our logical qubit, then we can further reduce the effective error level. And this reduction here, I state it's polylogarithmic, so it's efficient, meaning that if we just add a little bit more qubits, then we can have a drastic reduction in the error rate. And this will ultimately allow us to run computations indefinitely long and to have indefinitely or infinitely deep quantum circuits. This would be the ultimate goal, but we know the problem is that the redundancy that we need to introduce is a qubit scaling factor that is at least 5. And with the 5, I'm really, really optimistic because it can be up to hundreds or thousands with surface codes at lower thresholds. But let's just say it's at least 5. This is quite a lot already. But on top of that, we also need to invest in extra circuit complexity to constantly monitor stabilizers. And also we need to introduce highly non-trivial measures like magic state purification, because our gate set with error correcting codes is quite limited, and we have to do these highly non-trivial additional measures. And I would say each and every of these is kind of prohibitive for NISQ hardware, for the quantum hardware that we expect to emerge in the next few years. And so for this reason, people have come up with alternative methods, because we know that with error correction, we need a lot of physical qubits, very good physical qubits. And we know probably we won't reach that in the next years, let's say. And that's why the idea here in the near term is to instead use shallow quantum circuits. So I told you that the fidelity decays exponentially with the depth. So why don't we just restrict the depth to a shallow circuit? And it turns out we can still use these shallow circuits to quite useful tasks. And there are some really interesting papers on the complexity that we can achieve with these shallow circuits. And ultimately, what we want to do if we want to solve real-world problems, we want to do measurements at the end of this circuit and estimate expectation values. Basically, that's all the ingredients that we need. And we just, in the end, optimize these expectation values as a function of some circuit parameters, where here I assume that in the circuit, we also have the additional freedom that we can choose the rotation angles in our quantum gates, because we can do that with physical qubits and with near-term hardware. And basically, these are the ingredients, all that we need to do the very powerful VQE variants. VQE stands for variational quantum eigensolver. So it was proposed for finding ground states of molecules and physical Hamiltonians. But it has been extended to many other real-world problems, like to combinatorial optimization problems, QAOA, and even beyond, for example, quantum machine learning or finance, and so on. And our group has done a lot of work on this. For example, we have come up with a scheme where we can find optimal quantum states for quantum metrology via this optimization problem. And now it has turned out to be a broad field, an entire research subfield. And actually, 3 reviews came out very recently, just summarizing the topic of variational quantum algorithms. But in the end, we basically just used a quantum computer to estimate expectation values with a noisy quantum computer. And so in that sense, we can ask the question, why don't we just correct the effect of errors on the observables or on the expected values without actually correcting the quantum state? So you can think about it as error detection. So we want to throw away some parts of the expected value that we know corresponds to errors, and we want to keep the right expected value. And people have come up with these very cheap versions of quantum error correction, where we don't even need to increase the qubit count. Basically, all schemes build on the scheme that we want to figure out how noise affects an expected value, and we want to reverse this action of noise. And the simplest possible case is zero noise extrapolation. It's a really, really simple technique. It basically says that I want to run my quantum computer. Let's say I prepare some quantum states with a shallow circuit. It is noisy, but I anyway expect the anyway measure the expected value of the observable. I write it down, and now I increase the noise level of my gates by a factor of 2, let's say. And I again estimate the expected value. It will be something different. I plot it on a graph, and now I extrapolate back to the case where the error is 0. And this is zero noise extrapolation. It's quite a heuristic technique. However, it works surprisingly well. So we can go down these errors to the level of 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3, which is surprisingly good. However, people have come up with even more sophisticated, much more sophisticated techniques, I would say. For example, the quasi-probability approach. In this case, we assume we know exactly what is the error model in the quantum gate, in the sense that I can write down an error channel. It's a CPTP map. I can write it down in terms of Krauss maps, for example. And I can also invert it in many cases. I just take the matrix inverse of my superoperator and decompose that matrix inverse into elementary quantum gates. And now I just insert these elementary quantum gates into my circuit. I will have a cohort of different circuit variants. I run all of them. And surprisingly, the sum of these circuit variants will give us the exact error-free expected value. Reason for that is because I'm applying the inverse of the error channel onto the error channel itself, effectively, just via a post-processing step. And there are even more sophisticated approaches. For example, we know we can classically efficiently simulate Clifford circuits. So the idea is that we run a cohort of Clifford circuit variants, and thereby we can exactly learn the effect of noise in principle. And we can just, by a linear system of equations, we can just extract information for any non-Clifford circuit. And the real advantage of quantum error correction is that it does not increase the qubit count. And this is what we seek for near-term quantum computing, because we are limited in the numbers of qubits. However, in error mitigation, we don't actually correct the quantum states, and thereby we significantly increase the sampling costs. So this can be like a factor of 10 or 100,000, but even beyond that, depending on how deep my circuit is. And another disadvantage is that, as I said, we don't actually correct the quantum state. We really just correct the expectation values themselves. And for some of the techniques, for example, for quasi-probability techniques, we have to do additional non-trivial measures. Like we need to exactly know what is the error model in my quantum gate. In principle, we can do that with gate tomography, but that has an extra complexity. But most of all, we cannot really give guarantees how well the error will be suppressed in my observable. And second of all, we cannot really have like a parametric family of schemes where if I invest more efforts, I can exponentially suppress the errors. It did not exist before. Actually, is there any question so far? This was kind of just the introduction. Okay, it's clear. Okay, so now I come to this kind of novel error suppression technique. So I came up with the idea about a year ago, and it turns out Google have come up with the exact same idea, and they put their paper on the archive a week after mine. And now both papers came out in the same journal presenting very, very similar ideas. But it's actually a really simple trick. And it goes all the way back to the 90s, where people, before coming up with quantum error correcting codes, people were thinking about stabilizing computations with projecting onto the symmetric subspace. And especially there is a paper by David Deutsch. But it turns out it's really expensive to project onto the symmetric subspace of copies of a quantum state. And this idea was abandoned. But now the trick it's really just a simple trick with this idea is that it's really expensive to project the quantum state into the symmetric subspace, but it's actually really cheap to project the expected value effectively onto the symmetric subspace. And I will explain this in a bit. So this is the difference between like the old ideas and this new technique. So I show you a circuit here. So the main idea is that instead of just taking a single quantum computation, we we take many, so n copies of the same quantum computation, it can mean that we have multiple, for example, ion traps doing the exact same quantum circuit. And when they are done with the computation, this rho is our final state, our noisy quantum state that we want to measure to extract expected values. But now, instead of directly extracting the expected value, we entangle these copies via this generalized swap operation. And this will allow us to exponentially suppress the errors, because basically we take every copy and we use them to verify each other, whether they are exactly the same or different quantum states. And noise in these will break this permutation symmetry. But first of all, I'd like to just go back a little bit and explain why I'm using here a density matrix. And it requires a quite different way of thinking than in case of quantum error correction. Because let's say here is our mixed quantum state. We can think about it as a mixture of pure states. So rho one, rho two, rho three can be pure states. For example, rho one can be the ideal noise-free quantum state. And then rho two can be another pure state where an error happens after the execution of gate one. And this is how we think about errors in case of error correction, right? So it's like we think about possibilities of errors happening after happening locally after the execution of a certain gate. And then we can average over these quantum states weighted by their probabilities. And then we obtain the density matrix. Now it's a matrix. And we want to think about this matrix very differently now. We actually take the spectral decomposition of this density matrix. We know it exists because we know the density matrix is Hermitian, so it will have real eigenvalues. And in a finite dimensional system like qubits, it necessarily exists. And we will have these non-negative eigenvalues. And now I write it in a peculiar way. It's different that you might be used to. Actually, I take this part. This is my dominant eigenvector. So this is the eigenvector that has the largest weight here, the largest probability. And in the sum, I denote all the other eigenvectors of my quantum state. And what I know is that this eigenvalue is larger than any other eigenvalue here. And the interesting thing is, when I do this decomposition, my dominant eigenvector is actually a really, really good approximation of the state in which no errors happen. But it's only a good approximation if we think about these kinds of quantum circuits, these typical near-term quantum circuits. In that case, it's a really good approximation to think about the dominant eigenvector as the ideal noise-free state, or at least up to an approximation. And the reason for that is, in this NISQ regime, we are basically guaranteed to have very high entropy error distributions. I mean, the entropy of these probabilities here. So the maximum entropy is obtained when these are all identical. That means global depolarizing noise. Then I have the maximum possible entropy. And in that case, it turns out this state is exactly the ideal state. But we don't really have global depolarizing noise in reality, but it's a very good approximation, it turns out. And so actually I've written an entire paper just about this point, and I'll come back to this later. But now we just assume that this is a good approximation. And for the rest of the talk, we are going to work with the dominant eigenvector. And so let's say we prepare, we now just do a thought experiment. What happens if I do this? What happens if I take n copies of this quantum state? Then it turns out the most likely event is that I get n copies of the ideal pure state, the error-free pure state, psi, or actually the dominant eigenvector. And now if this happens, then I want to measure the expected value with this, the expected value of this sigma observable. And it's ingrained because this is what I want to know. This is what I want to learn about my quantum state, or in fact, about my quantum computation. However, if an error happens to just one of the registers, and we know this is going to be the second most likely event, that one of the registers is mapped onto an eigenvector with the second largest eigenvalue. This is the state that I obtain. And now if I want to measure an expected value with this state, you see I get the wrong error state. So here I measure the expected value in the error state, despite all my other registers are completely error-free. I measure a fully erroneous contribution. And now the main idea in this work is that, well, don't just measure the expected value of sigma. We have n copies. So now we swap the first and the last copies and measure the expected value of sigma times the swap operator. If we do that, then if we swap the ordering here, you can see that this psi is going to be matched with this psi k. And because of the orthogonality of the eigenvectors, this contribution is completely filtered out. So this means that if instead of sigma, I measure the expected value of sigma times swap, then I can basically zero out some error contributions. And we can generalize this idea. Oh, is there a question there?
Yes, so I was wondering, why is the error that it maps to an orthogonal eigenstate? Is this because of the global depolarizing noise assumption?
Not really. So actually, this is why I meant we now need a very different way of thinking. So it does not really mean that an error happened at the execution of the kth gate. Not at all, actually. It's an average state. But since I don't even know what is this average state or where it comes from, but I'm sure that since this is my density matrix, I can decompose it into eigenvectors, and the eigenvalues will be probabilities. And I can definitely say that with this probability, this pure state comes out of my quantum computer. So this is the way of thinking required here. And it's true for any noise model.
I guess you seem to be assuming that psi k is orthogonal to the dominant eigenvector.
Exactly. So all eigenvectors are orthogonal to each other.
So, but like, if an error happens if an error happens somewhere, I don't understand why it should map like the idle state psi to something orthogonal to it, I think.
Yes, but it does not correspond to an error happening locally. So if you work out, so you can do like a numerical test, for example, you run a circuit, a noisy circuit in a simulator. You take the density, it will produce a density matrix.
Yeah.
You diagonalize it and you take out the eigenvectors, and you look at the second largest, the eigenvector with the second largest weight.
Okay.
You will see it cannot be mapped to any single local error event. It's going to be a mixture of all the local errors.
I see.
Can I ask a related question?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think I understand the argument that you're making, but isn't it also true that the dominant eigenvector is not the ideal quantum circuit run on, you know, I mean, doesn't the dominant eigenvector also include sort of errors?
Exactly. So the dominant eigenvector will not be exactly the same as the ideal computation. That's why actually, I've written an entire paper about this, a pretty long paper about this effect, that if I introduce local noise into my system, still it's going to be a very good approximation to my ideal state. The reason for that is basically the entropy, but I'll get back to that later where I talk about these error bounds. It's really a difficult problem. It's actually related to the Weyl inequalities in mathematics. And so solving the Weyl inequalities took almost 100 years or 80 years, but it was like a major breakthrough. It's quite a difficult problem. Okay, but for now, let's just accept this. And if we do that, then you can see that we managed to filter out some error contributions, but still it's quite a naive scheme because we are just swapping registers 1 and n. It turns out we can generalize this to so-called derangement operators, which are generalizations of this swap. Basically, these just decompose into pairwise swaps of the registers in a way that they can exclude any contribution that breaks permutation symmetry. But this means that what I'm actually including here in the measurement process is the error-free dominant, well, not exactly error-free, but the dominant eigenvector n copies of it with the probability lambda to the power of n. And all other states or error eigenvectors that do not break permutation symmetry. So you see they are completely supported by the permutation symmetric subspace. And they occur with these probabilities. The nice thing is if I take more copies, then these probabilities are suppressed by the power of n. And unfortunately, this probability is suppressed by the power of n as well. So I will have to pay a price for doing this approach. But still, these contributions decay much faster because these probabilities are smaller. So, and that's what I want to see in the end. But somebody might say, okay, it's still not enough that I'm suppressing these by a power of, let's say, 2 or 3, because there are exponentially many of these probabilities. And if I sum them up, what happens if they are, since they are all positive, they will just sum up to some big number. And so for that, we actually have to look into the more into the details. But first of all, if we just write this down, the equation I explained here is going to be this expression. So it's basically trace rho to the tensor, so rho to the power of n. So it's an expected value in a power of the density matrix. And so now I'm actually explaining a different topic that I started to explain. Now I'm just going to explain that this probability decays with the power of n as well. We just measure this, an approximation to this factor, and divide by that. And that's how we can restore the green contribution here, the ideal expectation value that we want to measure. It's quite a straightforward procedure. One way to do that is, for example, we just replace sigma with the identity, and then we can measure trace rho to the power of n. So it's a Rényi entropy. And if we divide by that, then we can have a very good approximation to just this, the expected value we want to see. And now, sorry, I started to go into the details of this about the error bound. So I have exponentially many probabilities. I suppress them, but still I have to sum over these exponentially many contributions. I denote these with epsilon A and epsilon B, depending on with what kind of factor we are dividing. We can also divide by lambda to the power of n, but then we have to have very good knowledge about the eigenvalue of our state. This is doable with current experiments because there are techniques that can help us to estimate this dominant eigenvalue. But depending on how, with what factor I divide, I have two methods, method A and method B. And I want to characterize ultimately the bias to the expected value. And so I did that in the paper. And basically, this error is upper bounded by a sequence Qn, where n is now the number of copies. And we are guaranteed that this sequence here is upper bounded by an exponential function. So here now I'm talking about an upper bound of an upper bound. So Qn, the sequence itself, actually decays faster than this exponential. But the guarantee we get here is that there exists at least an exponential function that upper bounds my errors when I increase the number of copies. And here Q is just a number, and we raise this number to the power of n. But the interesting bit is, as I told you, it's really important that in the NISQ era, we have high entropy probabilities, and our bounds actually decay exponentially with the Rényi entropy of these probabilities. This means it's really desirable to have a global depolarizing noise. It turns out global depolarizing noise only has a trivial effect on expected values. So we shouldn't even bother with error mitigation if we just have global depolarizing noise. But it's not realistic to expect we have that. but still we have something that has high entropy, and that's really good for our bounds. And so I did some simulations with actual near-term like quantum circuits, and here are the results. So the red and the blue bars are the actual errors, so these, and the upper bounds are plotted here. If my copies of the quantum states are exactly the same. And you can see that on the logarithmic plots, I have a nice linear decay. And the difference between dashed and solid lines is whether I use the bounds based on the Rényi entropy, which is a tighter bound. Whereas if I use this upper bound of the upper bound via the suppression factor. But you can see both decay in similar orders. So based on the Rényi entropy, we can have tighter bounds, which more respects more this slope. But it also shows that if we just have four copies of the quantum state, in principle, we can suppress errors to a very low level, 10 to the minus 5. And this is probably more than enough we need for many NISQ applications, because ultimately we are estimating expected values and we are limited by shot noise. And that's a really expensive factor. So if you think about suppressing shot noise to 10 to the minus 5, we need to do 10 to the 10 measurements or on the order of that. So it's really expensive. So we probably don't want to suppress shot noise down to that level. So this also means we might be fine with just three copies, but it depends actually on the system. So is there a question?
Yeah, I have a question. So is this like exponential error suppression that you have listed on the last slide? Does it depend on this like global depolarizing noise, or is it just depending on the Rényi entropy? Like if you have some other like noise model, but still has a high entropy.
Yes. So this bound depends only on the Rényi entropy and on the dominant eigenvalue. And so if I have no knowledge at all about your quantum computation or the circuit you are running or the quantum device you are using, you just tell me the Rényi entropy of the errors and you tell me the dominant eigenvalue, I can give you a guarantee that the error will be within this bound.
Okay, that's nice.
But it's still with respect to the dominant eigenvector, which is not necessarily the same as the exact eigenvector. But in another paper, I have separate bounds for that. And that might be orders of magnitude below these errors.
Okay.
Okay, so let's go now. Let's discuss a bit the sample efficiency. So I've already mentioned shot noise. So here I'm interested in how many copies do I need to suppress to a given precision? And it's this logarithmic factor. But now I ask the question, how many shots do I need to perform to suppress my shot noise to this same epsilon? And the interesting bit here is that if I choose my epsilon to be like extremely small, like 10 to the 20, 10 to the minus 20, then I need a very, very large number of copies to reach that. But since the number of shots will scale exponentially with n, I will actually make my shot noise scaling extremely bad with that. But the interesting bit is here we have this logarithmic factor, and if we work out the rest, it turns out that with epsilon, so the target precision, we only have to pay a polynomial price. So you might recall that the standard shot noise limit is epsilon to the power minus 2. And here you can see we basically have a very, very similar polynomial scaling, but instead of minus 2, we have an F factor here that increases this polynomial factor. And it turns out in the simulation I showed you, which is a very, very typical NISQ kind of NISQ type circuit, their F is really small. So we are still quite comparable to the standard shot noise limits. However, if I use the same crappy gates with 0.1% error probability per gate, and I do 10,000 of them, it turns out this will go up exponentially with the number of gates to an invisible factor. The reason for that is short noise will scale exponentially with the number of gates. But if we can keep the circuits shallow or the circuit or the gate error rate sufficiently low, then we are guaranteed to have only this polynomial price here. Okay, so now I'm going to, or is there any question about this? Yeah. Okay, so now I'm discussing what are these permutation operators? I told you these are derangement operators. These are generalizations of the swap operation. And the swap is basically, swap operator is basically a representation of a permutation of a set of some ordered elements. And you might recall that there are overall n factorial possible permutations of this set, where my set is basically the labelings of my input density matrices. And derangements are those particular permutations that leave no element in position. So this means, let's say, 10 people sitting in circle on chairs, everybody has to stand up and find a new chair for themselves. So they cannot sit in the same chair. So these are derangements. And for these, we have a large number of possibilities still, although not n factorial, but it turns out comparable to this number. So for n equals 2, we only have one possibility to just swap 1 and 2. So you see, I take psi 1, psi 2, I end up with psi 2, psi 1. It's quite straightforward. For 3 copies, now I have 2 possibilities to do these derangements. I can take 1, 2, 3 and reorder it into 3, 1, 2, or I can reorder it into 2, 3, 1. This is still quite simple because what I'm just doing here is a cyclic, basically the two possible cyclic shifts. But if we go for higher copies, like for example, for 4 copies, you already have 6 possibilities. So we have all the possible cyclic shifts, but we also have permutations of these. And so if we go for 5 copies, we already have a huge number of possibilities, but we only need to use one of these, any one of these. And it depends on the architecture. So this is really favorable for having different kinds of architectures, because you might imagine an architecture where quantum processors sit next to each other, like 5 of them. Let's say for simplicity, 4 of them, 4 quantum processors next to each other. We could do a cyclic shift, 1, 2, then 2, 3, and so on. But then each and every will have to wait for each other. But we have another derangement where we can do these in parallel. So we can swap 1 and 2, and then 3 and 4. And now in the next second step, we just swap 2 and 3, and we are done. So these offer more favorable opportunities than just doing the naive cyclic shift. And how do we actually implement this in an experiment? And that's a good question. So it turns out this can be implemented very efficiently, because if we want to swap 2 registers, then what we do primitive controlled swaps between pairs of qubits in the 2 registers. So now you can see I have 2 registers here. The first one, the 0th one in red, the first one in blue. And I'm just applying the control swap between pairs of qubits. And if we count the number of primitive control swap gates, it's n times n minus 1. And it means that we have a linear scaling in both the problem size, capital N, and in the number of copies. This is really good. And it also guarantees that this part of the computation, where we just swap around the registers, is going to be shallower than the state preparation stage. The reason for that is here we have a linear number of gates. That's comparable to a constant depth circuit. And we know that constant depth circuits will not suffice for state preparation, we have to have at least a mild scaling in the depth of the state preparation stage for most of the typical NISQ applications. So we know that ultimately, if we scale up the computations, then this part will going to win because this will be shallow compared to the rest of the algorithm. This is really good news because here we have quantum gates and these will pick up noise as well. And the error bounds I showed you basically don't take anything about noise into account. So I assume that these gates are perfect, which is not realistic. So these gates will pick up noise. But it turns out if we want to be really frugal and want to recompile these controlled swaps into elementary native quantum gates, the cheapest way possible, we don't even need to exactly recompile them. Well, actually, we still exactly recompile them, but we can do it in a way that we leave out some elements from here that don't affect at all the measurement outcome. And so then it turns out we only need 5 or 4 entangling gates to recompile a controlled swap into these elementary native quantum operations. And so this really means that we just have a few gates to implement this scheme. To actually put this into numbers, I do some simulations here. And I take a 6-qubit spin ring Hamiltonian. It's kind of one of the entry problems, the simplest you can think of with the least required resources. And for that, it turns out we have to do 360 entangling gates for the main computation, whereas we only need to do less than 30 gates for the derangement process. So this also means that we have at least an order of magnitude difference between the derangement operations and the main computation. So this also means in practice, it's a feasible scheme. And here I do some simulations. So red are the unmitigated energy expected values of this Hamiltonian. And orange is kind of one of the leading techniques, extrapolation. It reduces the errors by roughly an order of magnitude. Now, if I take 2 copies with my derangement trick, then you can see if there is no error in the derangement operator, that's the blue dashed line, I can reduce the errors by many orders of magnitude because I basically square the error probabilities. And if now I take into account the noise in the derangement operations, so the error in the controlled swap gates after recompilation, so I'm actually now taking into account characteristics of an ion trap system, then you can see that still I'm reducing the errors by orders of magnitude. I'm not there as with the ideal case, but it gives me a very, very good performance. However, if the circuit error rate is too large, meaning that in my circuit, for example, there is an expected error 1 in every execution of my circuit, which is kind of at the edge of what is feasible with NISQ. So we cannot really go beyond this because then the sampling cost will increase infeasibly. So we kind of want to limit NISQ applications to the left from here. But here you can see I'm not really much better than extrapolation with this derangement trick. Reason for that is 2 copies is not enough. Now the green line shows what if I have 3 copies, you can see I'm now much better than with extrapolation. And so I showed you I can take arbitrarily large n and I can exponentially suppress the errors with respect to the dominant eigenvector. But it turns out it's not really useful to go beyond, let's say, n equals 4, because I hit this error floor. And this error floor is because my dominant eigenvector is not exactly the same as the ideal computational state. And this is the ultimate fundamental limiting factor in my algorithm. It's still a bit pessimistic, actually, because I can do much better than this with some recent techniques from some follow-up papers. But I'm just showing this to you as more like a worst-case scenario. And also my ground state, so my Hamiltonian is the simplest, cheapest possible, people interested in quantum chemistry will do much chunkier than this. And that will require a lot more gates for the state preparation stage, meaning that ultimately the derangement will be a cheap operation compared to state preparation. And so I told you, ultimately, we are limited by these coherent errors. Yes, there is a question, I think.
Yeah, I have a question. So this derangement operator is essentially like relabeling each of these copies. So why couldn't we just, like, rather than actually applying gates, just sort of and then do a controlled sigma operator?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we are actually, it's relabeling, but it's also controlled on the ancilla. So it means I have a superposition of my original ordering plus the reordered version.
But so like imagine, so if this first row in the derangement was like based, just swapped with the second row, couldn't we just like control the sigma to either act on the first qubit or the second qubit rather than swapping all of the qubits?
So it won't suffice, actually. So here you really need to use superposition, because what you ultimately want to see, is that you have a superposition of the original state and the swapped, the reordered state, as you can see here. And because of this superposition, you can measure these kinds of expected values. Yes, so the answer is no, you can't really do it with just post-processing. Okay, so I told you that ultimately we are limited by this coherent mismatch, so that we are not exactly in the ideal state with our dominant eigenvector. And it's generally true that this scheme is completely oblivious to all coherent errors. But the whole point of NISQ and variational quantum algorithms is to have an optimization algorithm running on top of this that will minimize coherent errors. But still, if there is any coherent error left, I can't do anything about that. But now if you think about this problem, I don't have coherent errors at all. I just have an exact ideal quantum state, rho id, and I have an other erroneous quantum state. Let's say this represents all the error events, like in the case when we think about quantum error correction. My density matrix is a sum of these, and now this one is exactly the ideal computational state. If I add these matrices together, unless they commute, the eigenvalues of this matrix will be different than just the sums of the eigenvalues here. Reason for that is the very well-known Weyl inequalities. However, now let's consider a generalization of the Weyl inequalities. What happens to the eigenvectors of these matrices? It turns out the same principle applies here. Unless they commute, the eigenvectors will not be exactly the same. And this is this coherent mismatch. It's the change in the eigenvector of the matrix. And it turns out it is in stark contrast when compared to the Weyl inequalities, because it turns out the Weyl inequalities are saturated when these two matrices commute. In the case of the eigenvectors, we actually get the least possible zero shift when they commute. So it's a very interesting difference. And so in this paper, I go into the details. I derive some bounds based on commutators, commutator norms of these matrices. But actually, the message is really positive here. It turns out with these kinds of near-term quantum algorithms and quantum circuits, this error will be really small, and you can already see in these pessimistic estimates. So gray is well below like a reasonable shot noise limit, because as I said said earlier, we don't really want to like measure expectation values up to precision 10 to the minus 4, because it's just too expensive in terms of shot noise. You just have to do too many measurements. Yes, and before I finish, I just wanted to mention we have this very convenient quantum simulator. It's called Questlink, and it's a very competitive code. It's written in C, and we have a mathematical front end that's called Questlink. And so I did all the simulations with this tool, and I can recommend you just test it out. You can do GPU acceleration as well as distributed computing. And it's one of the fastest codes out there. And thanks very much for the attention. And yes, if you have any questions, please feel free to ask.
I don't know if it's a, maybe it's more of a comment. So the this largest eigenvector appearing in your analysis, mm-hmm. it reminds me a little bit of the analysis of in-place error amplification for QMA, where you also have the largest you also want to sort of analyze the largest eigenvector of the QMA verifier circuit. Not sure if there's any, in that analysis, it's useful to use this Jordan lemma, but probably not in your case, but I thought I would just mention that because of my experience.
Can you remind me what is the Jordan lemma?
Oh, just when you have, it allows you to put two projectors into a form where they're both block diagonal with blocks of size 2.
Oh, yeah, it's relevant. It's similar, but a bit different here. So for this problem, I had to use a different kind of decomposition. It's a very well-known decomposition, at least in computing. It's called the arrowhead matrix decomposition. So you can prove that this matrix takes up an arrowhead form where you only have non-zero positive entries in the, or sorry, non-negative entries in the density matrix, only in the diagonal and in the first row and column vectors, and it's obviously Hermitian. So the column and row vectors are the same, and you have zeros everywhere else. And so I use this decomposition, and for this you can actually analytically solve the eigenvalue problem. You can analytically obtain the eigenvectors in terms of these matrix entries, and it turns out the vector norm of the column vector is exactly the norm of the commutator between these two matrices here in any Schatten P norm up to some 2 to the power of P factor. And so it's a really convenient case. The reason for that, why it's so simple and why I can solve it analytically, is because this here is rank one projector. This one here is any density matrix, so it's any non-negative Hermitian matrix. Whereas this is a very, very special one. And for this, I can analytically solve the problem with some math. So it takes some time, but you can work it out analytically. And so in the paper, I comment on it. Is it possible to solve similar problems with general matrices here? So in some sense, a complete generalization of the value inequalities to all eigenvectors with general matrices. And that's a quite difficult problem, I guess. I haven't even tried.
Thanks.
Thanks for the nice talk. I just wondered if this has been implemented in a hardware platform by you, or does this other paper by the Google group?
Yes, so there are some differences to the Google paper. First of all, they have a kind of cheaper scheme where they don't actually do it with the Ancilla. So they mention it's possible to do it this way, but the cheaper version of theirs directly measures this expectation value by sampling from the output. Mm-hmm. But in order to be able to do that, you first have to diagonalize this so that in the standard output, this is diagonal. And for that, you have to apply some unitary transformations to your state. That means right before the measurement process, you entangle the two copies with just local 2-qubit gates. And then you can measure directly from sample directly from the output. And sorry, what was your question?
Oh, just about if they did they implement it in hardware?
Yes. And that's more obviously more convenient to implement in hardware, because then you don't need to have here this nasty ancilla, which will pick up noise and so on. And so I assumed characteristics of ion trap systems where we have no limitation in connectivity, whereas Google have nearest neighbor interactions, so they can't really do this. So they didn't do the experiments, but since then, follow-up papers came out, which show that you actually don't need to do the Google scheme. You just run one computation, do some measurements on your state, and run the inverse of the computation, and measure the probability of the zero state, so that you successfully reverted and computed your state. And so if you do that, you can basically achieve the same two-copy performance, like in some sense squaring the errors. And that has already been implemented in hardware. So there's been an evolution since the archive papers came out. The question is how can you do efficiently the three-copy case? And I think probably for that you need to do the ancilla version, and that hasn't been implemented up to my best knowledge.
Thanks.
Anyone else has any question?
I have a maybe slightly off the wall question. And it's about this, you know, property of the top eigenvalue of the density, or top eigenstate of the density matrix.
Yeah.
Looking like your desired output state.
Yeah.
So let's say I have some error model and some quantum circuit, not necessarily NIST or NIST. Mm-hmm. And I want to modify my quantum circuit so that it has this property under this error model. So I want to somehow change my quantum circuit so that the top eigenstate looks like that. Is it known if you can do that or how well you can do that? Or
so at least I did a comment in the paper, and I think Google have also left a comment in their paper that this is in some sense a coherent error, and it will automatically be taken care of by the VQE optimizer, because you anyway optimize the angles of your quantum gates, the rotation angles, such that the energy is minimized. So it depends obviously on the circuit and on the error model, how much you can minimize this error. But in principle, VQE will do this to some extent. So it's inherently robust against these kinds of coherent errors. But there is a more sophisticated approach described in one of the follow-up papers where they use subspace expansion. So you might have heard about this technique. It basically means that we measure the Hamiltonian matrix, so a small matrix representation in a subspace of my Hamiltonian. And if you do that with this approximation, then you can mitigate the coherent errors quite well. And so it's a technique that was specifically designed for mitigating coherent errors. Yeah.
Towards the end of, I guess, 18th or 19th slide, you showed data for 6-qubit spin ring. So what is the Hamiltonian for that?
Oh, yeah. So it's a spin ring, meaning that we have on-site sigma z interactions for all the 6 spins. And we have x, y, y, z, z interactions between nearest neighbor pairs on the ring.
X, X, Y, Y, and Z, Z interaction.
Exactly, yes. Yes, between the nearest neighbors in the ring.
The nearest neighbor, like Heisenberg model, I guess.
Yeah. And I just generate, so I fix the coupling strength, so the prefactor of X, X, Y, Y, Z, Z, and I randomly generate the prefactors of sigma Z. And so it's guaranteed to be strongly correlated. And so I think it's one of the kind of entry problems which is non-trivial to solve, but still has the least number of terms.
Okay, so
thereby here I basically show the worst case scenario for NISQ.
Thanks. And in slide 5, I guess you were talking about something related to quasi-probability representation.
Yes.
You explained it, but I couldn't catch it then. Can you explain it a little bit more?
Oh, yes, of course. So it's another technique. So it's not really related to my talk.
It just belongs
to this cohort of different more sophisticated error mitigation techniques. And so the idea is that, so let's say we just have a single noisy quantum gate. We exactly know the error model. For example, it's a depolarizing noise. So if I execute my gate, there is a probability that an X, Y, or Z error happens after my gate. And I can write this down as a Krauss map. And in the Krauss map, I will have X, Y, and Z unitary transformations summed up. And these act on the state that comes in. Now I can invert this super operator. It has the same form, basically, just with minus prefactors. So these are no longer probabilities. These are quasi-probabilities because I have a negative prefactor. It's no longer a CPTP map. It's not a physical map. It's just a quasi-probability representation of the inverse of the channel. So now what I can do, I apply my noisy quantum gate, measure the expected value. And now I also apply my quantum gate, but after the gate, I append an X gate, which will exactly revert the effect of the bit flip error. Now I again measure the expected value, and I do the same for Y and Z errors as well. And since I know exactly the probabilities of X, Y, and Z errors, I can just subtract these contributions from my expected value. And this will basically, in the end, this will exactly recover my expected value, the ideal one. The problem is if I have more than one gate, then I will have exponentially many terms for which I need to sum.
Thanks a lot.
No problem.
Does anyone else have any questions?
Sorry.
If not, let us thank Balint once again for a very nice talk.
Thanks very much for the invitation.